Could up to half of the peer-reviewed scientific literature be untrue? How is the billionaire Walton family working with school districts and the U.S. government to privatize education? Were there stories of indigenous resistance and struggle against oil and gas pipelines that matched or even rivaled that against the Dakota Access Pipeline resistance in North Dakota? Could increased rates of cancer in indigenous communities at the Grand Canyon be related to radioactive pollution from abandoned uranium mines? Is there a silent epidemic of military veteran suicides in Canada? Why are these and other important stories not getting more attention in the major media? On this week's Global Research News Hour, the first of 2017, we spend the show examining some of the most censored and suppressed stories of the previous year. We speak to Andy Lee Roth, an associate editor of Project Censored. We speak to John Shurto, editor and publisher of intercontinentalcry.org. And we hear from an associate professor from the University of Regina's School of Journalism, Patricia Elliott. On this week's program, Censored 2016, the most important stories that you never heard about. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 6th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Global capitalism is by no means monolithic. What is at stake are fundamental rivalries within the U.S. establishment marked by the clash between competing corporate factions, each of which is intent upon exerting control over the incoming U.S. presidency. In this regard, Trump is not entirely in the pocket of the lobby groups. As a member of the establishment, he has his own corporate sponsors and fundraisers. His stated foreign policy agenda, including his commitment to revise Washington's relationship with Moscow, does not fully conform with the interests of the defense contractors, which supported Clinton's candidacy. That comes from the article, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Campaign to Destabilize the Trump Presidency, by Professor Michelle Chalcedovsky, post January 4th. The NATO war preparation against Russia, Operation Atlantic Resolve, is in full swing. 2,000 U.S. tanks will be sent in coming days from Germany to Eastern Europe, and 1,600 U.S. tanks is deployed to storage facilities in the Netherlands. At the same time, NATO countries are sending thousands of soldiers in to Russian borders. According to U.S. Army Europe, 4,000 troops and 2,000 tanks will arrive in three U.S. transport ships to Germany next weekend. From Bremerhaven, the U.S. troops and huge amount of military material will be transported to Poland and other countries in Central and Eastern Europe. That was from a reposting of an article by Donbass International News Agency under the headline, Political Insanity, Outgoing President Obama's Operation Atlantic Resolve Against Russia. U.S. sends 3,600 tanks against Russia. Massive NATO deployment underway. With an introductory note by Michelle Chalcedovsky, post January 4th. The move towards a cashless society would secure a further degree of control over India by the institutions who are pushing for it. Securing payments that accrue from each digital transaction would, of course, be very financially lucrative for them. These institutions are therefore pursuing a global war on cash. Small wealthy countries like Denmark and Sweden can bear the impact of a transition to a cashless economy, but for a country such as India, which runs on cash, the outcomes so far have been catastrophic for hundreds of millions of people, especially those who don't have a bank account, almost half the population, or do not even have easy access to a bank. but regardless of the large-scale human suffering imposed as a result of demonetization, it could kill two birds with one stone. One, securing the interests of international capital, including the eventual displacement of the informal, i.e. self-organized economy, and two, acting as another deliberate nail in the coffin of Indian farmers, driving even more of them out of the sector. That comes from the article, India, From the Destabilization of Agriculture to Demonetization, Made in America, by Colin Todd Hunter, posted January 5th. The Fukushima nuclear power plant accident in Japan 6 years ago has not been fixed. It is becoming increasingly evident that it is difficult to fix it. As three reactors' nuclear fuel rods were melted, there is no precedence for such a disaster in human history. The health effects of radioactive material released are becoming significant day by day. Unfortunately, its reality has been covered up by the Japanese government. What's more, the government is eagerly trying to restart the nuclear power plants, as many as possible, having done so three nuclear power reactors so far, despite the fact that no electricity shortage has been experienced when no single nuclear power plant was in operation for 2 years, 2013 to 2015. That comes from the article, Fukushima Radiation Looms, No Nuclear Power Plant on Planet Earth, The Incompatibility of Radiation with Human Life, by Aikiro Okiai, posted January 5th. Let me summarize the British government's contribution to the genocide in Rwanda. Britain used its diplomatic weight to severely reduce a UN force that, according to military officers on the ground, could have prevented the killings. It then helped ensure the delay of other plans for intervention, which sent a direct green light to the murderers in Rwanda to continue. Britain also refused to provide the capability for other states to intervene while blaming the lack of such capability on the UN. Throughout, Britain helped ensure that the UN did not use the word genocide, so the UN would not act, using diplomatic pressure on others to ensure this did not happen. That comes from the article, Britain's Role in Rwanda's 1994 Genocide, by Mark Curtis, posted January 5th, originally appearing at markcurtis.info. Nobody would believe, either in the UN General Assembly or any other public forum, that United Fruit supported or opposed governments based on democratic convictions. On the other hand, no one would dare challenge the actions of the US government abroad to assist a government it declared to be democratic. Moreover, if United Fruit broke the law, the local government could punish it even by expropriation, but no local government would dare take such action against the United States itself. That could mean even war. Hence, the CIA was invented in the National Security Act, not simply as an advisory and coordinating instrument for spying, but as a criminal organization to cover for the fundamental criminal activity of U.S. corporations and those who own them. That comes from the article, The History of the CIA, Review of Douglas Valentine's Book, by Dr. P. Wilkinson, posted January 5th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. 2016 has been a notable year for news, with the Standing Rock protests, the election of Donald Trump, and the deaths of a plethora of celebrities. As has become an annual tradition on the Global Research News Hour, we're bringing a review of the important stories that did not make national or international headlines. We're joined now by Andy Lee Roth. He is the Associate Director of Project Censored. He's here to tell us about the organization's top 25 most censored stories of the year. So, Andy, thank you once again for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be on the air with you.
Can you just very briefly explain to us Project Censored and what it's all about?
Yeah, Project Censored, our primary mission is to expose and oppose news censorship in all its guises. So, you know, the latest spate of fake news comes to mind. And we also do quite a bit with media literacy education, especially for college students, college and university students, who many of the stories we'll end up talking about today are stories that have been researched by students at colleges and universities across the country and indeed up in Canada as well, who are working in Project Censored affiliated courses with professors at those campuses.
Okay, great. And you're based in Sonoma County in California.
Our home base is originally at Sonoma State University, but since we started this what we call our campus affiliates program, we're in many ways a much more kind of horizontal and decentralized organization than we were at our outset 40 years ago.
Okay, well, well done. Okay, there are a couple of stories, certain themes running through some of your top 25. There's a couple with a sort of an educational theme, you might say, one on the Department of Education collusion with something called ALEC to privatize the educational system in the United States. Also another one having to do with, let's see, Walmarting of the educational system. You can give us a bit of a breakdown of those stories.
Yeah, and so I should say just before we dive into any one of the stories, part of what we do at Project Censored every year is we monitor news stories that are being covered in the independent press that are either not being covered at all in the corporate media or are being covered in a way that is partial, in one or both senses of that term, partial incomplete or partial in a biased or slanted sort of way. And so these two, our number 20 story, the Walmarting of American Education, and number 22, on the Department of Education cooperating with ALEC to privatize education, both fit those criteria. They've been well covered in the independent press and not so well covered or covered in distorted ways. So on the Department of Education story, ALEC is, of course, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a lobbying organization. The main gist of this story, which was originally reported in PR Watch in January of this year by Dustin Bielke, is that a slide deck, PowerPoint-type presentation made at the Department of Education revealed the extent to which the federal government has been supporting boosting charter schools, and Bielke reports on this December 2015 slide presentation that shows over $3 billion in taxpayer money to boost charter schools, and describes the 25-slide overview of the Department of Education's charter school programs as an uncritical PR document that embraces a magical idea of charter schools.
Mm. Yeah, and of course, so as we're seeing like this all whole, the educational system increasingly becoming more and more privatized. The Walmart story with the Walton family involved in that is also a very concerning development, it would seem, one that you're not hearing much about, that goes along with the closing of a whole bunch of Walmart stores, right?
Exactly. That's exactly right, Michael. And this goes back, if you trace it back, it's the kind of alignment of a philosophical sense of the world between the Walton Family Foundation and the economic philosophy of the libertarian Milton Friedman, who was part of the kind of agenda under the Reagan administration to challenge this, quote, rising tide of mediocrity, and they started what many of us today think of as a myth of public school failures. And so the Walton Family Foundation announced a plan in January of this year, right around the time, as you mentioned, that they were announcing closure of some 269 of their retail stores. announced that they would be spending billions of dollars over the next 5 years to support and expand charter schools in 13 U.S. cities and states. They were, as Education Week reported, they were doubling down on their investments in what's known euphemistically as school choice, but is really, again, part of this larger privatization agenda.
Mm. Now, you also have a couple of stories that discuss the prison system.
Yes. Yeah. One of those is our number 17 story this year on deadly medical neglect for immigrants who are held in these privatized U.S. jails. This story was originally reported by Seth Fried Wessler in The Nation earlier this year. He spent more than 2 years attempting to obtain the medical records of more than 100 inmates, all of whom were immigrants, who died in custody in these privately run prison companies. These are the companies that may be familiar to some of the audience, the Corrections Corporation of America, GEO Group, and a little less well-known, the Management and Training Corporation. And they run these private prisons. In this case, the ones that Seth Fried Wessler ultimately undertook a federal lawsuit in order to obtain the medical records of these 103 prisoners. The standards in these prisons are different because they are contracted privately. And so what Wessler found when he began looking at the documents, the medical records, were that many of these men died unnecessarily. They suffered from critical delay in care for things like mental illness, heart disease, liver conditions. They often were not diagnosed correctly for what were obvious and painful but treatable symptoms. And in many of the cases, in nearly 20% of the cases, licensed vocational nurses were undertaking the kind of treatments that would normally be appropriately the work of medical doctors, and these were clearly cost-cutting measures that were possible only in a privatized setting. Mm-hmm. There are two updates that I would add since the Censor 2017 went to press. There's some good news on this story. In August of this year, the Deputy Attorney General directed the Bureau of Prisons to reduce and ultimately to eliminate their use of privately operated prisons. In her memo, Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates said that private prison facilities do not provide the same services or resources, they do not save money, and they don't maintain the same level of safety and security. There was no mention of Seth Fried Wessler's report in The Nation, I'd like to believe that the publicity given by his report was part of the decision there. When that report was made, when the Deputy Attorney General made that announcement, the stocks, the CCA, Corrections Corporation of America, stocks plummeted 35%. The GEO Group stocks went down 40%. The update on this would be that on the day after Donald Trump appeared to have won the Electoral College, he, of course, has been an advocate of privatized prisons. Those stock shares skyrocketed. CCA went up 43%. GEO Group went up 21% on the news of Trump's victory. And for people following that story, an important development that I came across last month, the Corrections Corporation of America, which certainly should be followed and should be on our radar, has rebranded itself as an organization now known as CORE Civic, which is the two words CORE and Civic all is one word. And these companies, I think that the upshot of this story is that these companies, to quote one of the American Civil Liberties Union's people who follows the prison issues, Carl Takai, he says these companies, by their nature, depend on and profit from mass incarceration.
Yeah, and I know that the medical system seems to be kind of highlighted in this series. I mean, there's a story here, not only the one you just mentioned, but also the U.S. vaccine court paying out over $3 billion to vaccine-injured families. Number nine, Big Pharma lobbies outside of presidential election campaigns, about seven times more than during a mm-hmm. presidential election. And this one that really came as a shocker to me, crisis in evidence-based medicine. Derived from an article that was actually in The Lancet. Do you want to talk about that one?
Yeah, that's our number two story this year, and the Lancet article is from April of 2015, when the editor of that very prestigious medical journal, Richard Horton, wrote, "Something has gone fundamentally wrong with one of our greatest human creations." And he continues, "Much of the scientific literature, perhaps half, may simply be untrue." And what he's pointing to are studies conducted with small sample sizes, studies that find effects, but the effects are tiny, exploratory analyses that don't have complete validity. And, of course, what's probably the most important of these is the flagrant conflicts of interest that often drive medicine. Now, there are two points to, I think, add to the piece that Horton published in The Lancet, that is the core story for this crisis in evidence-based medicine. First of all, he's not the first prominent editor or editor. He's not the first editor of a prominent medical journal to raise these concerns. Back in 2009, Marcia Angell, who had been the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, had raised very similar concerns. But to me, in some ways, the most interesting aspect of this story there was some coverage. There has been some coverage of you know, the corporate media will from time to time cover stories on clinical trials and how clinical trials are affected by external interests. The Washington Post, for instance, has run some stories on this very scandalous study of the drug paroxetine. But what's interesting is in what little corporate coverage there is, the corporate coverage never mentions one of the solutions that are being put into effect, right? So if we have a crisis in evidence-based medicine, is there anything that can be done about it? And one of the, there's the independent news stories that we cover as in the censored book on this topic are following what's known as a new open trials initiative, and a very specific one that's known as the Restoring Invisible and Abandoned Trials, which has been promoted by the BMJ, which many people will know as the British Medical Journal. And the idea is that any kind of clinical trials data under or any kind of clinical trials undertaken by pharmaceutical companies would have to make all of the data from those trials available for independent scientific scrutiny. And various of these campaigns now have the backing of literally hundreds of medical and research organizations. So this is one of those cases that I always find very interesting at Project Censored when we look at these underreported stories, where it's not simply that the story is underreported, but the bad news part of the story, there actually is a good news counterpart, or at least a solutions perspective. But that solutions perspective is in the case of this this story has been omitted by the corporate media coverage, but is very prominent when you look at the independent journalists, the work of the independent journalists who have been covering the story. Mm. And so that fits very much a notion of the corporate news as serving specific agendas and not necessarily serving the task of informing the public in a way that would allow us to be engaged citizens and community members.
Okay, well, we've got plenty of other stories here. I mean, NYPD editing stories on police brutality in the Wikipedia, the modern-day slavery, sex trafficking of underage girls, the global epidemic of electronic waste, Internet Surveillance Act nobody's discussing.
And you know, there's 1.5 million U.S. families living on less than $2 a day. So these, I mean, we don't have time to go into all of these in depth, but I do certainly encourage people to check out the website projectcensored.org. But it's also, as you mentioned, there's also a book on that's available, and this, the top 25 is really only the first chapter in a 10-chapter book. So you want to maybe give us a bit of a breakdown of some of the other features in that book.
Yeah, just very quickly, I'll point to a few highlights. And of course, I you know, with more time, we'd talk some about each of the chapters, because each is a kind of a gem in its own right. This year is Project Censor's 40th anniversary. One of our regular features in the book is what we call Deja Vu News, where we go back and look at well, what happened to stories that were in the top 25 lists from previous years? And this year, since it was our 40th anniversary, we asked our panel of esteemed judges who help us to identify and rank each year's top 25 to help us identify five or six stories from the entire history of Project Censored that they would like to see updates on. And so Susan Rahman, who teaches sociology at College of Marin, in Northern California, Susan Rahman and her students did our Deja Vu News 40th anniversary edition Deja Vu News chapter this year, strolling down Memory Hole Lane, and we've gone back all the way to 1977 when the number one story was The Myth of Black Progress. That's updated now. Our number one story in 1987, The Information Monopoly, a story written by Ben Bagdikian, we've brought up to date. And then we've gone back, for instance, to No Habeas Corpus for Any Person, the number one story in 2008. So Deja Vu is a look backwards and bringing those stories up to the present. Every year we have a fantastic story. I think in many ways it's the best place to enter the Project Censored book each year. We look at Carl Jensen, our founder, called Junk Food News. And so we have an updated chapter on junk food news and news abuse, a term that Peter Phillips, the past director of Project Censored, coined to capture another way that news can work as propaganda. And this year's chapter on junk food and news abuse, which is done by Nolan Higdon and students of his, is all focused on the news coverage of the presidential primaries. And there's just some amazing stuff here, including among the junk food stories, Les Moonves, the chairman of the board, the president and the CEO of CBS, one of our major networks, of course, saying that he's never seen anything like this on the Trump, the attention to Trump in the primaries, and he says, and this is going to be a very good year for us, meaning CBS. Sorry, it's a terrible thing to say, Les Moonves said, but bring it on, Donald. Keep on going. So we have a whole chapter of analysis with those kind of nuggets.
Okay.
Later in the book, we talk some, we have a chapter from Susan Merritt on conspiracy theories and thinking about how conspiracy theories operate in a period where there's increasing government surveillance and government secrecy. We have an amazing chapter by Brian Covert, who many people who read the book each year will know. Brian always does tremendous work for us. Brian has written a very accessible chapter that looks at basically the history of the CIA, the press, and how those relationships have resulted in distortions to our news. And I could go on. There are many other good chapters here.
Yeah, it sounds quite fascinating. And certainly I would encourage our listeners to pick up a copy. It's Censored 2017, and it's featuring all the most underreported and censored stories or suppressed stories of the past year. Andy Lee Roth, thank you once again for joining us. I really appreciate this contribution.
Thanks so much, Michael. It's always a pleasure to join you.
We've been speaking with Andy Lee Roth. He is the Associate Director of Project Censored.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
you focus solely on mainstream or even a lot of alternative media, you'd think that the standoff at Standing Rock is the only story of import in terms of Indigenous resistance. However, as my next guest can confirm, there are plenty of stories of Indigenous struggle around the world getting systemically ignored by the press. Intercontinental Cry has a mandate to document these stories and report them to a wider global audience. John Chertow is the lead editor of Intercontinental Cry. He joins us from Winnipeg. Hello, John. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So I think that there's a, in terms of some of the big stories that that weren't quite fit to print in the major media, there's another story here. One of the stories you've got is about 16 pipelines that are moving forward in the U.S. that impact Indigenous lands.
Yeah, there's at least 16, including the Dakota Access Pipeline, that affect Indigenous lands throughout U.S. and also, you know, pipelines that originate in the U.S. That also affect Indigenous lands in Canada and in Mexico. We're talking about, you know, 16 major movements, even though none of them have really become movements except for, you know, those against the Keystone and the Dakota Access Pipeline. But, you know, there is one movement now that's slowly being developed, and that's concerning the Agua Prieta pipeline, which runs from Arizona to Sonora, Mexico, through Yaqui territories in Mexico. The Yaqui have actually been resisting that since October, and there was a violent altercation in October that resulted in the death of one Yaqui person and the injury of eight others when, you know, supporters of the pipeline attacked the protest camp. But this was taking place, you know, nearing the height of the movement against the Dakota Access, and, you know, there was no mention of it anywhere. I didn't even hear about it, and I'm, like, tapped into, you know, everything. So it's pretty alarming that we haven't heard anything. I'm trying to get some people down there to start covering this. But, you know, there's several other pipelines, too, that have also started coming forward, especially in light of no DAPL, such as the Trans-Pecos pipeline in Texas and the Sabal Trail pipeline, which runs from Alabama to Georgia down to southern central Florida, also affecting Indigenous lands. You know, and there's basically no coverage anywhere about any of them.
Mm. Now, I noticed there's another story that you have listed. It's about the Wisharika people, in the Indigenous peoples who are being threatened by land grabs from Mexican ranchers. What are the dynamics of that story?
Well, it's fairly complicated, actually. Like, the Mexican government started appropriating the Wisharika lands in the early 1900s. They appropriated about 10,000 hectares. And, you know, the Wisharika, or also known as the Huichole, you know, I guess they let it slide, basically. But they've been moving in more recent times to reclaim the land, and, you know, they took the legal approach, and they've, you know, exercised their legal right to the territory in, like, nine different land claims or something like that, most of which are still, like, stalled out in court. And but they're, you know, just tired of jumping through these legal hoops. So, you know, they started in September to take back the land directly by occupying it. So in September, like, a contingent of at least 1,000 Wisharika mobilized to reclaim the land. And the situation is actually extremely volatile due to the nature of the, or at least the sentiment of the current landholders. You know, non-Indigenous ranchers and other, you know, business-oriented folks who tend to look down on the Wisharika as, you know, less than human, which is a sentiment that we see throughout the world. But, you know, like, there was one of the largest landholders in the region when the Wisharika mobilized, publicly called the Wisharika a plague, for an example. And there was one headline in the region that screamed that the blood is going to run if these, you know, insects get their way. There was also individuals in the region cited wearing military clothing and carrying weapons that are exclusively used by the armies, AK-47s and R-15s. But they disappeared, and somehow, fortunately, thankfully, cooler minds have prevailed so far. There haven't been any violent altercations. And instead of letting the situation become a racism-fueled ground war, both the ranchers and the Wisharika have asked for the governments to act as a third-party mediator to resolve the situation. And that's kind of where the situation stands at the moment. Everybody's waiting for the government to step in and resolve this.
Oh, my.
We just had one of our editors, Tracy Barnett, was just there like 2 weeks ago. And she's probably going to go back for updates because, yeah, like this situation could turn ugly very quickly.
Mm.
So we're keeping eyes on it.
Now, here's another story basically relating to the uranium mining in the Grand Canyon and its impacts on the Havasupe and Diné peoples.
Yep.
Uranium mining, as I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, about 75% of the uranium in the United States is on treaty or federal land. And so there's bound to be disproportionate impacts on indigenous peoples. So what's happening here in the territory?
Most people, think that there isn't any uranium mining within the Grand Canyon area where uranium mining has, historically taken place. There's, tens of thousands of abandoned uranium mines already there. But, earlier this decade or last decade, the U.S. government opened up the lands for prospecting, which resulted in 30,000 new uranium mining claims. That in turn resulted in the moratorium. And because of that moratorium, people think that there isn't any uranium mining ongoing in the region, but that's not true. There's at least three mines, uranium mines, owned by Energy Fuels Resources Incorporated. One of those mines, which is located on the traditional territory of the Havasupai people, and which this particular mine called the Canyon Mine is near a place called Red Butte, which is a mountain that's held sacred by the Havasupai. The Havasupai believe that all life began in this region. There's also a watershed in the region that could be affected, but the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality has been, very accommodating of EFRI. They've, given them everything that the company wants. And, most recently, the company applied for air permits so that they could transport uranium from the Canyon Mine, which they're actively drilling, to their processing mill in Utah. The ADEQ, gave them all the permits. So next year, I'm not sure of the exact day, but the company is going to be transporting, the uranium ore 300 miles from the Canyon Mine to the processing mill on flatbed trucks or, on like dump truck type things, 30-ton trucks, I think. And the uranium ore is only going to be secured in place by tarps that are, quote-unquote, securely tied down with rope. Anybody who understands uranium knows that if the rock can let off dust, which will go directly into the air and can potentially contaminate anything along the way. But apparently that's acceptable. So there's a movement slowly building that is going to be trying to stop this project. And if anybody wants to learn more about that, they can go to halno.org. HALNO.org you can get updates on the situation there.
Yeah, I'd certainly encourage that. That's certainly a story that deserves further exploration and updates.
Absolutely.
Colombia, there's a peace accord put together between the FARC and the government, and it was rejected in a popular referendum by a slim, narrow margin, but it's the indigenous peoples are apparently looking to implement it anyway. This is a story by Hannah Wallace from October.
Yeah. Like the situation is, obviously very precarious for the indigenous peoples in the region because, as a result of this 52-year conflict between FARC and the Colombian government, at least 64 of the 102 indigenous nationalities in Colombia are now facing extinction. So, you know, they've been, desperately trying to bring an end to the conflict on their territory, obviously for decades, but they've been, you know, caught between three parties and all, not just FARC and, other leftist-oriented groups, but also the Colombian government and, you know, paramilitary groups, right-wing groups. The peace accord obviously would have brought an end to at least the conflict between FARC and the government, and so there was no really resolution with regard to the paramilitary groups. But aside from that, the indigenous peoples are just sick and tired of having their families kidnapped and murdered and forced into labor by this or that group or whatever, and being pinned against each other and infiltrated, and having their territories filled with landmines, and then being forced to serve as canaries, so to speak, who walk in front of the armed groups in case they run into landmines and so forth. Mm. So, they're trying to implement, aspects of the peace deal that will benefit them and that are appropriate for their territories. And we actually have somebody in Colombia now who's monitoring this process. And, he reported last week, we just published a story about it, that paramilitary violence is actually on the rise in Colombia this particular year. So like when the peace accord was just on the table, paramilitary violence started rising. And in the past, paramilitary groups like the Black Eagles primarily worked in any way that would serve state interests, and they're basically still doing that. But now that Colombia and FARC are kind of sitting nicely together, they're becoming like more independent, like private security services that are still like as vicious as ever, but they're still acting but they're more acting independently, but still in the service of the state. So like it's very difficult to know how this situation is going to be resolved without the Colombian government stepping in and demobilizing all these organizations, if they can. Either way, I think the indigenous peoples are going to continue to move forward so that they can, finally, after so many decades, live safely within their own territories.
I think we've only got time for one more story, and this is one having to do, it's called Photos Behind the Miskito Curtain, and this refers to indigenous peoples in Nicaragua, and it seems kind of interesting because the villain would appear to be the Sandinista government, which people on the left typically tend to put on a bit of a pedestal. So
yeah, they're not necessarily the villain. The
enablers.
Yes, that would be much more accurate. The so-called villain, or at least the antagonist would be the better word, are the settlers known as colonos, who are actively and violently and illegally seizing Miskito territories using fake land claims. And who knows, like nobody knows where these land claims are coming from. But, President Daniel Ortega has at least admitted publicly that they're illegal, but he, as far as taking action to stop them, they haven't. He hasn't done anything yet. So IC visited the Miskito's traditional territory earlier this year, the word on the street was that the Miskito were organizing themselves into an armed militia in the event that the Ortega government failed to, respond to their calls for justice and peace, because like these colonels are flooding homes with machine gun fire. I mean, like there's a lot of people that are being killed. And, there was also some discussion about, instead of taking a more aggressive approach, that they would simply organize a self-defense force similar to what the Purépecha town of Chirán did in Mexico, by arming itself to banish a Mexican cartel from their land and lives. it's not like the nothing has really come about at this point. You know, the mosquito are still, you know, hoping and begging for the government to just get off its butt and, you know, do what it needs to do. Unfortunately, you know, as with so many of these other stories, the media is virtually silent. I guess it's to be expected, but it's very alarming that the alternative media has been particularly silent. You know, and that is largely because we're talking about, you know, something that is being enabled by a very popular and very beloved, you know, leftist government. And, you know, there's even been some media publications attacking IC and anyone else who sides with the mosquito, because it, you know, threatens to tarnish the image of the Sandinistas. And it's very unfortunate, but, you know, I guess that's just, you know, one of the many difficulties that indigenous peoples face.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so John, thank you for joining us. Is there anything you'd like to say with regard to Intercontinental Cry? I know it's 100% financed by the readers. So, I mean, is there an ongoing fundraiser or any other upcoming events that people should be aware of?
There is an ongoing fundraiser. We are basically out of funds. We have enough money to run IC for another maybe 8 weeks, if we're lucky. So, like, if anybody sees value in these stories or really supports Indigenous frontline struggles, I encourage them to come over to intercontinentalcry.org and pitch in.
Okay. John Chertow, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
John Chertow is the lead editor of Intercontinental Cry, a permanent volunteer-driven platform that raises the voices of the world's 5,000 Indigenous peoples. He joined us from Winnipeg. Before we close the show, this being a Canadian broadcast, I thought it would be instructive to touch briefly on Canadian stories that somehow didn't receive major coverage. Joining us by phone from the University of Regina is Patricia Elliott. She is associate professor with the University School of Journalism and was also a faculty advisor with Project Censored. Greetings, Professor Elliott, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks very much for inviting me.
Okay, so, I mean, there are a number of stories that here in Canada didn't get a lot of attention. Maybe we'll start off with a story that's kind of gotten resurrected in light of a recent tragedy in Halifax, a military murder-suicide. There are a couple of stories here relating to Canadian veterans, one having to do with the alarming suicide rate, and another about Canadian soldiers returning to life in the streets. You want to maybe just elaborate a little bit on the significance of those stories?
Sure. So what we asked the students to do is to kind of look outside the box to find stories that were under the radar last year. And Tanessa Wild, one of our students, she looked at two stories dealing with vets, one on the rate of suicide and one also on the rate of homelessness. And certainly these are issues that are no doubt related. There has been mainstream coverage when there's been a tragedy of some type, as we're seeing now. So it's not like it's been entirely ignored, but certainly we've seen a bit more attention. In this case, it was the news outlet Rabble, online source of independent news, that has spent some time really looking into the situation of our veterans in Canada. I think our American counterparts were quite surprised when they read these stories, when we submitted them to Project Censored, because although this is a major issue in the U.S., I don't think they saw it as there being any sort of equivalent in Canada, but we certainly do have these problems here too.
Amazing. Yeah, so we're talking about some, I think over the course of 2 years, I can, something like 54 suicides?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it is, as it was headlined, an alarming rate. It's something that, again, we see this being talked about within that world, among the people involved, but no sense that it's being systematically tracked and kept in the public eye. So what Tanessa found was there had been some stuff in the Globe and Mail. The Globe and Mail is actually does a pretty good job on a lot of overlooked stories. But certainly nothing of in-depth really looking at why this is happening here in Canada as well.
Mm. Now, another story I'd like to bring up, and I guess this resonates in the sense that there's been a lot of talk about missing and murdered women in Canada. And I noticed the story about unsolved cases of murdered women in Halifax, and in which you build on the case of the conviction of one Glenn Assoon, who is a wrongful conviction. You know, do you want to maybe elaborate a little bit on this this rash of murders in Halifax?
Yeah, this is a story that was uncovered by Joelle Seal when she was looking for stories absent from the mainstream. It is the reporter who's been covering this is a owner-operator of an online alternative news source called the Halifax Examiner. Very good independent investigative reporting coming out of the Examiner. And it's a winner of a Canadian Association of Journalism Award for investigation on some of their work. So what happened was the reporter in this case was looking into a wrongful conviction, and in the course of this discovered a whole raft of unsolved murders in Nova Scotia, and sort of brought that to light. It's not something we had heard about. I had never heard about this until I read the report on it that came from the Examiner. And it's a very good example of women who simply go missing. Their families are concerned, but nobody's putting the pieces together and really looking at, is this a case where the wrong person was jailed and an actual killer was still on the loose?
Sounds a little like, because I noticed these are murders, these murdered women were on the margins of society. Mm-hmm. It seems somewhat like it resonates with the Picton murders on the West Coast, no?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and again, that the Picton murders, again, that was an example where it was well known about, well talked about among the affected communities, but no traction outside those communities. And that's been the whole story around missing and murdered Indigenous women as well. If you were involved in any way in reading feminist news outlets or Indigenous news media, this was a story that's been around for decades, but never broke through to the mainstream until recent years.
Hmm. So it seems like the stories aren't being, or lessons aren't quite being learned or something.
Yeah, well, I mean, this will happen, and that's why I tell the students, don't discount sources that are non-mainstream, because that's where you'll often find the stories that are bubbling that people are talking about, but aren't getting the attention they need.
Here's another story that I'd really like you to discuss. Ontarians can't afford dental care.
Yeah.
2.3 million people in Ontario can't afford to visit a dentist or dental hygienist.
Yeah, and that should be a major health story because we know so many other health outcomes are connected to dental care. That's a story that my student Allison Bamford looked into. We can relate it to, in Saskatchewan, we had our northern dental care internship program was closed. So there's another story that did not receive much attention, but maybe should, to look at what is going to be the impact on this, on northern communities that really relied on a dental care program.
Yeah, here's another one I want to get into. Migrant workers and the campaign for permanent residency to protect their rights. And I know that there's a large underbelly. Part of what makes our economy works, unfortunately, is a lot of exploitation of these foreign workers who don't, you know, they don't have the same benefits as the rest of the population. And so there's a story here, this harvesting freedom issue. You want to just maybe give us the skinny on that one there?
Okay, now that was a story. It was about a group that launched a petition campaign to begin lobbying for the rights of migrant workers. These are some of the toughest stories. If you've ever been involved in social movements, launching a campaign and it just hits dead silence in the media, this is kind of what happened. I mean, it's not like migrant workers have never been covered in the media, but for groups that are really trying to make a change, it tends to be those stories don't really get picked up that often. you know, it's not, you know, these are the kind of good news stories where people are trying to make a difference, but they are seen as either too radical, too fringe, or not exciting enough for the readership in the mainstream media, so they simply get ignored.
Yeah, and then that's sort of like with the murdered women in Halifax story all over again. Just basically people, depending on who's affected, they don't quite matter or not fit to print.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's as clear-cut as that. Newsrooms across the country are also under a great deal of stress. They don't have a lot of available staff to cover anything.
Here's one more. I think we'll just we should just touch on, and this is, I guess, technically this happened in 2015, but the question of Israeli Defense Forces suspected of shooting a Canadian Palestinian artist.
Yeah, that's quite a shocking story, and not just kind of random fire in the course of an uprising, but actual sniper shot that. The artist, Rahab Nazal, was injured in the leg by a bullet that appears to be an IDF, the type of bullet that they use. I didn't hear, I think, the local press in London reported on it. And again, Rabble has been great in covering a lot of these stories. So I know Michael Joel Hansen, or no, it was Brandon Harder, the student who looked into that one, found some stuff on Rabble about it. But to me, as a Canadian, that would be quite shocking to know that one of our nationals was a target over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I guess I just in the time that remains, I was wondering if you could just give us maybe your take on what insights you have into the forces specific to Canada that might be conspiring to keep certain important and impactful stories off the media radar screen.
Right. Well, I think specific to Canada, we just have a very... our media ecology here is just unhealthy. We have a very low level of competition among the mainstream media, very few incentives for them to dig harder. There was an opportunity, like we have huge media concentration here, and study after study has shown this is where it leads, to a very complacent media. There was an opportunity when the National Post chain bought out Sun Media. It went before the Competition Bureau. Even though this was a debt-ridden company that had promised to keep the Sun papers open in each market as separate newsrooms, as soon as that was approved, they began closing and consolidating newsrooms. So you've got complacent mainstream media, and then alternative media, which does a relatively good job. In Canada, that means... to keep that media operating, we have a system of government grants. Those grants were pretty much decimated down to nothing under the Harper government. So our alternative media is also struggling a great deal to cover these stories.
And it sounds like that it's a worsening trend.
Yes, definitely in terms of mainstream media. Basically, it's not just the marketplace that has failed, but also our government that has failed to protect us from excessive concentration and to hold these media companies to account for delivering the news, which is what we really need. I don't think there's a loss of appetite for investigative reporting out there. And I don't think there's a lot of great journalists who want to do that kind of reporting. So it's finding new ways to do it, whether that's through cooperatives or through arm's length foundations that can support investigative journalism. But definitely we're lacking it right now.
Well, it's been good to talk to you, Patricia Elliott. Thank you very much for those perspectives.
Great talking to you, too. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We've been speaking with Patricia Elliott, associate professor with the University of Regina's School of Journalism and a faculty evaluator with Project Censored. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.